Welcome to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You're here with your host, Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse. And you can always find us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. We have many on-ground classes. That means you come in your physicality and you join us, where we do herb walks, we do outside herbal identification, and how to make the wild plants in your area into medicine. And those go on all around the country and are also discussed in our book, The Natural Medicine Chest. We also have a certification course in holistic medicine, and that depends on what level you'd like to study at. We have a doctor level, which is actually out of Australia through Health Masters Live, on such information as herb-drug interaction and drug-nutrient depletions, which really should be a part of everyone's standard of practice in terms of developing a protocol for any individual. Today, we are so happy to have as our guest Dr. Victoria Sweet. Dr. Sweet has been a physician at San Francisco's Laguna Honda Hospital for more than 20 years. She is an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, and she is a prize-winning historian with a PhD in history and social medicine. She's the author of several books. The one we'll be looking at today is God's Hotel, A Doctor, a Hospital, and a Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine, and she is working on additional titles that will be coming out shortly. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Sweet.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, okay, very good.
Just fine. Beautiful. They do have you all hooked in.
Excellent.
Appropriately.
Excellent.
So we're happy to hear you.
Yes.
So I'd like to just go back in time a little bit into your own personal history. And what led you to have a different viewpoint of your relationship with being a physician?
It's a really interesting question because I've actually been asking myself that more now than I ever have before, partly because I keep getting asked that. It just seemed a very natural way to see the patient, you know, in two different ways. But it did sort of develop, I think, more gradually. It sort of developed as I practiced. So I didn't realize, in other words, from the get-go that the way I saw people was different exactly. I don't actually know.
Okay, well, let's go back
and
in
let me
time
just tell you, Ellen, I didn't, we're on the air, right?
Oh yes, we're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to say though, I'm on the east. I'm on the west coast.
Uh huh.
I have not yet had my cup of coffee yet this morning.
Oh no.
So I'm about ready to have this wonderful natural, herb-based drink called coffee. So I expect that I will be even. You know, I will. My pace will pick up in a few minutes.
That's absolutely fine. Yeah, sometimes that's a little challenge. California doesn't seem too bad. I've had people on from Australia and New Zealand, and it's literally, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning at their location. So
Sure
you'll catch up with us.
Yeah, so I'll catch up. So I should be hanging out with you pretty well in just about 2 minutes.
Well, this is an award-winning book, which is wonderful in terms of God's Hotel. You actually were able to get some really excellent recognition.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And you also have now been awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship, which is a very big deal.
It's been a very fascinating journey, I would say, partly because I got to Laguna Hot. So I've had a rather unusual career, and the kind of recognition I've gotten rather later in my life has been fascinating because I can't say I exactly expected it. The Guggenheim especially was really amazing to get that. I had a feeling, though, that if I could capture the hospital, the unusual hospital where I worked, and its patients, and if I could take my readers on the same journey that my patients had taken me on, that people would respond to it. And part of it, I've decided, has a lot to do with just the general timing of things. I'm convinced that if I'd written the exact same book 5 years ago, 6 years ago, let's say, I'm not sure this all would have happened with it. But people are really, when the book actually came out, it was like hitting the beginning of this wave that was cresting, that's crested now. So my timing for God's Hotel was really, I was lucky. Because we're all thinking about this, and I think one of the reasons that the book has gotten a lot of interest from the get-go is that what I'm talking about in the book fundamentally is these different ways of looking at patients. It's also a different way of looking at life. I think we're all grappling with the results of what's happened in the last, let's say, 10 years, particularly in healthcare, as patients, as nurses, as doctors, where all of a sudden, you know, instead of essentially a sort of a fundamentally humanistic view, where the doctor talks to you and listens to you and tries to figure out what's wrong with you, we've got this mechanical view, which has now been turning into a computer view of the body, that's really alien. It's very alienating. It's useful, but it leaves us all as doctors and nurses and as patients feeling bereft. And I think in general we're bereft in our work, in our lives. So what I'm talking about, because this is such an old hospital, you couldn't exactly, you know, it didn't feel very technological. It was really old-fashioned place with old-fashioned values.
Yeah, I want to tell people a little bit about it, because this is San Francisco's Laguna Honda Hospital. I imagine Honda put some money into it, got their name on it, which is wonderful. And what
No. That's not what happened at all.
Okay,
I'll tell you.
Okay,
carry on. No. well, actually, no. It's Spanish.
Oh, so you mean Honda.
Yeah, Honda. So Laguna Honda means deep water. Oh, I should let you finish here. You see, I'm warming up now. Coffee's getting to my head. Okay, carry on.
Well, what we're just, and thank you, because actually so many places, like you're saying, in modern times, when these big corporations come in, they do put their names on something. And I didn't even think of it as being Onda, which is deep. But what you describe this hospital as, and we're talking here with Victoria Sweet. She is the author of God's Hotel. You can find her at victoriasweet.com. You can find God's Hotel anywhere, including Amazon, etc. And she is really telling a story about a doctor, a hospital, and a pilgrimage to the heart of medicine. How she describes it also is as an almshouse in the country. I think those of us who have seen, like, Ask the Midwife, one of those shows, you see these kinds of places that really we don't see so much anymore. And it's a descendant of the Hotel Dieu, the God's Hotel, that cared for the sick of the Middle Ages. Very, very interesting. And it was set up, I guess, when was it set up? In the 1960s or so?
Oh, no. So in the 1860s.
Oh, it's that old. Okay.
Oh, yeah. So the thing about the almshouses, and I had a traditional education as a physician.
Conventional,
right. Traditional, 4 years of medical school after I did, you know, years in college, and then I did a residency in internal medicine. So I'm a board-certified internist. And I practiced for about 10 years, mostly in community clinics. I've always liked practicing with the poor, actually, because I find them kind of pretty interesting and provocative and compelling. And after about 10 years of actually practicing medicine, I started to become aware that behind or in addition to the model of the medicine I'd been taught, which is, I think, is modern medicine's a wonderful, effective way to find out what's wrong with somebody. I mean, compared to 2,000 years ago, nobody would want to go back to what I call pre-modern medicine. Nevertheless, a lot of things have been dropped out, and I began to be aware as I practiced that there was like a whole way of looking at the body that was left out of the medicine I'd been taught. And at some point, I decided I was going to try and figure out what that way was. And so it was around that time, sort of serendipitously, I ran into a book that really surprised me. Just ran into it in the library. I was kind of open to finding something, and it was called Hildegard of Bingen's Medicine. So it turned out that this Hildegard of Bingen woman was a 12th century nun. She, your listeners may actually know her because while I was working on her medical book, her music was rediscovered. Her 12th century music was rediscovered. She was also a mystic and a visionary and a composer. And she'd written this book on her medicine, her 12th century medicine, so almost 1,000 years ago. And I sat there looking at it in the library, and I was really shocked as I read it because it wasn't the eye of newt, toe of frog medicine I expected from a medieval medical text. It was a real medicine for real patients with real diseases that I could recognize, but it was based on a completely different model of the body than my mechanical model I'd learned in medical school. So it reminded me most of holistic medicine, of Chinese medicine, of Ayurvedic medicine, and I became just fascinated by this, trying to figure out what it was. So I decided to go back to college, to graduate school, and get a PhD in history, and Hildegard was going to be my focus. But I didn't want to stop practicing medicine part-time, and that's how I got to Laguna Honda, because I was looking around for a part-time job as a doc, as a doctor, which was not easy to find at that time. I spent a couple of months. Just as an aside, it was pretty interesting going around looking for a part-time job at the time.
Yeah, and this sounds like a match made in heaven to bring you to this environment.
Well, who knew, right? But what was interesting, even at the time, everybody wanted a woman internist. All the women wanted women internists, right? Women were just starting to really get out and be docs, but they wouldn't let me work part-time. And so they were offering me these jobs, and I was going, people, if you want a woman, you're going to have to, like, loosen up here and get a little flexible. So I didn't get really anything that I wanted until I got to Laguna Honda Hospital. And when I saw it for the first time, I have to tell you I was shocked because it didn't look like a real hospital. It looked like a medieval monastery. You know, talk about serendipity and synchronicity.
Oh, my goodness.
I drove up to it, and I knew about it because I had admitted patients before to it, but I'd never visited. And when I drove up for my interview and I looked at the hospital, it looked like this medieval monastery. It was high on a hill overlooking the Pacific Ocean out here in California. It had cream-colored walls and red-tiled roof and a turret and a bell tower. And I went for my interview, and then when the medical director showed me around, I was just blown away, right? She shows me, first of all, the place was right in the middle, and still is, right in the middle of San Francisco. It's on, to this day, 62 acres of land right in the middle of the city. It had, at the time, almost 1,200 patients. 1,178 patients, and they were all taken care of. We were taking care of them on the old-fashioned Nightingale wards. You know what I mean by Nightingale wards, Ellen?
Well, you know, as a nurse and as a holistic nurse, Nightingale is one of our big power animals, let's say. You know, we honor her work. So, yes, I am somewhat familiar with it, although I certainly have never worked on one.
Well, I became absolutely, that's a whole other story, but I became totally taken with Nightingale. I have been possessed by her ever since this time. They're called Nightingale wards, so they're the old-fashioned ones that you see in the old movies, the long
hallways
where patients are, there's 30 beds in the ward, they're under windows, the head nurse is at the front, and there's a solarium at the back, and Nightingale designed these in the 1860s. After she'd come back from her horrible experience in the Crimea, where all those thousands of men had died purely from the way the hospital was designed. So she spent a couple of years touring all the hospitals of Europe, and she decided that hospitals should be made up of mini hospitals, because at the time, of course, they did not, in the 1860s, there was no antibiotics. So the most important thing, if you had somebody with an infection, was to be able to quarantine them. So she made these hospitals with long open wards. They were like mini hospitals, 30-bed hospitals, which would have a kitchen, bathrooms, a treatment room, off a long corridor, so that if somebody on that particular ward got sick, you could shut the corridor off and essentially quarantine them. So Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco was originally, in the 1860s, the San Francisco Almshouse, and it was rebuilt a number of times since the 1860s. And the last time it was had been rebuilt when I showed up was in 1926. So 1926, almost 100 years ago. And they had built it along this Nightingale plan. So as we walked around, and the medical director showed me these open wards, it had its own x-ray department, but from the 1920s. It had a laboratory that we would, you know, look at the microscope ourselves, read our own x-rays. It had its own church, a little chapel, even though it was run by the city. And that chapel was really more like a church, actually. It was, I said it was little, but actually it was pretty big. It had wooden pews and stained glass on the walls and a very politically correct Stations of the Cross. She showed me it had gardens. It was immense. So I started practicing there, and at the same time I was studying Hildegard of Bingen's, this 12th century nun's medicine, the other half time. And as these two things went on, I began to get insights into what I think we forgot about the way medicine needs to be. I started calling what Hildegard was teaching me slow medicine. And what I was using at Laguna Honda, learning at Laguna Honda with my patients, slow medicine, because I decided it was a lot like the slow food. A lot of the principles were the same. We had slow food, you know, the slow food movement.
Oh, yeah, I'm a big member of that.
as opposed to fast food. Well, really, I thought, you know, really what we've forgotten is a kind of slow medicine as opposed to fast medicine, which works fantastic, fast medicine does, when you have a fast disease. You know, if you get hit by a car, you have a stroke or a heart attack, or particularly a heart attack, or even cancer, fast medicine with its model of body as machine works really very well. And I wouldn't want to change it for Hildegard's medicine. But after we've had our surgeries, our chemos, then fast medicine kind of drops the ball. And that's where I think slow medicine fits in, slow medicine that looks at the patient in the context of an environment and tends to not just take things slowly, temporally, but uses a lot of the same principles as slow medicine, as slow food.
Yeah, that's a wonderful explanation of the difference. Now, it's amazing that a hospital like that could still be running in today's environment. Let me just ask you this: how do they do the billing?
Mm-hmm. So I've described the structure of the hospital, which was very old-fashioned. But the actual running of it wasn't particularly old-fashioned, and I'll explain that in a minute. The whole thing was so ironic, Ellen. It was just so delicious, especially since I'm a fourth-generation Californian, and my family landed in San Francisco in the 1840s. And so I'm very aware and very fond of the history of San Francisco, which was embedded in the physical place. But the physical place was literally around the block from the University of California, San Francisco. We had, you know, very well-trained docs, very well-trained nurses. There was a billing department way at the end in one of the, they would take, you know, it's kind of interesting. So the billing department was in one of these long Nightingale wards. But they had we had computers, and we had billing. And I'm happy to tell you that the billing was just as inefficient and incompetent as billing any place else in this country.
That's beautiful. Well, we're going to just take a little break right here, And we'll let you finish your cup of coffee.
Very good.
We'll listen to Natural Medicine Chest, which is a production that Dr. Zamperone and myself have made on little aspects in holistic medicine and herbs. And when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion. Listeners, as you can see, this is a fascinating book. It's called God's Hotel, A Doctor, A Hospital, and a Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine. We're discussing it with the author and physician Victoria Sweet, who is also a PhD historian, and she's sharing her personal story and a spiritual story it is as well about being led in the right direction when you open the doors to your heart. So we will be right back with more right here on Natural, the Natural Nurse, and Dr. Z here on Progressive Radio Network.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the folklore, history, chemistry, and medicinal applications of the common kitchen herb, thyme.
The common culinary spice known botanically as Thymus vulgaris is only one member of a large genera which includes over 400 species and even more varieties. The Thymus genera is originally native to the Mediterranean region and is a perennial plant which grows wild in usually dry, sandy soil, green heaths, and grasslands. Thyme is a prolific, fragrant, creeping ground cover and often displays an attractive spray of flowering branchlets spanning the spectrum from white to violet.
There is considerable debate amongst historians as to the origin of the name thyme. Some believe it to be from the Greek thymen, meaning to fumigate or to burn a sacrifice, because it was used as a sweet-smelling incense and also to keep pests and venomous creatures away from the Greek home. Others believe it came from the Greek thumos, meaning courage or energy, perhaps because it has a reputation of being used by Greek warriors for courage and was bathed in and used as a beverage for invigoration. The Egyptians used an herb called thyme, which we believe is Thymus vulgaris, to mummify their dead. The principal chemical constituents of thyme are the volatile oils consisting of phenol, thymol, and carvacrol. A 1977 article in the scientific journal Chemical Abstracts revealed that thymol's antimicrobial activity is 18 times more powerful than phenol. Phenol is a major antiseptic used in commercial germicidal cleaners like Lysol. Thymol is one of the most potent antimicrobial substances known and far surpasses even the strongest antibiotics. It has been illustrated in the Journal of Chemistry and in the Merck Index of Drugs and Chemicals to destroy parasites, worms, fungi, bacteria, mosquito larvae, and many viruses.
The pharmaceutical and cosmetic industry is privy to the important medicinal effects of oil of Thymus vulgaris. It is ubiquitously found in gargles, cough drops, vapor rubs, and many mouthwashes. Oil of thyme is to be used, albeit very sparingly because of its potency, as a gargle or mouthwash for sore throats and inflamed gums. Because the volatile oil is expelled via the lungs and kidneys, naturopathic physicians use it for upper respiratory infections and urinary tract infections. If you're in the midst of a cold and are lying in bed with too much thyme on your hands, try making a thyme tea made with just a few teaspoons of thyme to a cup of boiling water. It's an excellent diaphoretic because it causes the body to perspire profusely. Thyme also possesses an excellent carminative and antispasmodic effect, helping in poor digestion, flatulence, and intestinal gripe.
So, listeners, if you're feeling ill, thyme heals all wounds. Remember to reach for that thyme in a bottle the next time you open up the Natural Medicine Chest.
Thank you.
again to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, right here on Progressive Radio Network. And one of the wonderful things about having a show here on Progressive Radio Network is that you can tune in anytime, 24/7, no matter where you are in the world. Just go to prn.fm. There's wonderful shows, and we'll have a little explanation about the other shows later today, but we have all the Natural Nurse shows archived, so you just scroll down to The Natural Nurse and click on that, and you'll see all of the shows. I think we have over 108,000 podcast downloads of our shows, so we're very, very happy that people are enjoying them. And we also look forward to your feedback. You can visit naturalnurse.com or Facebook The Natural Nurse and view the many books we've written, the classes that we give, and all the ways that we can interact with you. So we're happy that you're joining us today. Guest today is Dr. Victoria Sweet. She is an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California and a prize-winning historian with a PhD in history. She practiced medicine for 20 years at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco, where she began writing. And she wrote her book, God's Hotel, A Doctor, Hospital, and a Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine, which came out a couple of years ago, and she's currently working on a new book. So why don't you tell us about that project as well, Dr. Sweet?
I would be happy to. Ellen, let me just say that it was delightful to hear the spiel on time.
Oh, yeah. We have hundreds of those.
Well, of course. But it was just very well done, and I don't too often hear such a nice balance between history, chemistry, and current use.
Well, thank you. That's what we specialize in.
Well, it's nice for me because, you know, of course, that's part of what I learned from Hildegard. You know, she, of course, time was in her armamentarium, and that's mostly what she used were medicinal herbs in her practice.
As did all physicians until very recently.
Of course. And most of our really good drugs are based on some kind of natural medicinal herb that we've sucked the what we think is the major principle out of and then turned around and sold them back to our patients for 1,000 times what it cost us. What could be better?
So one thing you talk about in God's Hotel, I guess there was a time that other kinds of people who felt that that this particular hospital should be brought up to modern standards.
Yes.
So that's a little bit of a sad story, but why don't you share that with us?
Sure. And I'll get back to my current project. I will talk
good.
About
we won't
that.
Let you leave without that.
No, it'll be good. And I also want to talk a little bit about the pilgrimage.
Excellent.
Because this was really a life-changing experience. In fact, I think I'll talk a little bit about the pilgrimage first because I think it segues into what happened to the hospital. So,
perfect.
So I came to the hospital apparently serendipitously. I was exploring Hildegard of Bingen's medicine, and of course that led me into deeply into the Middle Ages, which is really the basis of our culture. I mean, a lot of the contradictions, a lot of the strengths, and a lot of the weaknesses you find in our culture today, you can directly go back to Hildegard's period of time, which really was the 12th century. It was, you know, for some of your listeners, it was, you know, Eleanor of Aquitaine, Saint Bernard, the Crusades, Heloise and Abelard, many, many of the really interesting characters were in the 12th century, as was Hildegard, and Hildegard knew most of them, which was pretty interesting. And so when I studied her, I had to go back and understand that period. So I also, she wrote in Latin, and I didn't want to read her in translation, so I learned Latin.
Wow,
and
that's
medieval
impressive.
Latin. Because she was German, and most of the secondary sources, most of the stuff about her was written in German. I also learned German and medieval German. It was actually a lot of fun because it was a nice counterbalance for what I was also doing at the same time in the hospital, which is a very intense place. It was very intense because I called the book God's Hotel because, as you pointed out, I took the name from what we used to call hospitals, which was God's Hotel, and they still call that in French, the Hotel Dieu. And Dieu in French is French for God. So it's what we used to call hospitals. And in English, the equivalent kind of hospital, we've always called an almshouse. And most people under about 50 haven't even heard the word almshouse, which is kind of interesting to me. So it's a place, it was typically the Laguna Honda kind of hospital was how we took care of the sick poor before there was health insurance. Because we had a way to do it. And the way we did it is we created these hospitals in cities, one hospital per city, that was open to everyone. And that's what Laguna Honda was. That's what an almshouse was. That's what the French hotels Dieu's were. And it's kind of an interesting way, when you think about it, to take care of the sick poor. Instead of having these complicated, expensive insurance systems, there was just a big old hospital. And if you were sick and you needed it, you could just go, and it was open to everybody. It didn't cost anything. Very interesting.
What a concept.
I like the concept. I think it's really efficient. You know, I still think that it would be a nice layer to add to our safety net, to have one hospital in every city that you could just go. No questions asked. You just show up, and maybe it's not perfect, and maybe it's, you know, open wards, and it's a little old-fashioned, but we weren't that old-fashioned. And you knew, regardless, you could go someplace and be taken care of. And that concept started in the 12th century. It actually came out of the nuns and monks who felt it was their primary duty to take care of the sick poor. And so in every monastery, there was what they called a hostel or a hospice. And that hospice was where the nuns and the monks, like Hildegard, would take care of anybody who knocked on the door as a spiritual practice, as a religious practice. And it was those monastic hospices that turned into hospitals. And it was that concept that taking care of the sick poor was something that I don't want to use the word obligation because it really wasn't. Well, I will because I haven't finished my coffee yet.
it's a good enough word.
Well, it wasn't so much an obligation. It was almost a duty, but also
a privilege.
A privilege, that's exactly it. So it was those monastic hospices that turned into the hospitals of Europe. And when our country was founded, that concept was actually brought to the United States and started in Philadelphia. This idea that, you know, we were going to have a civilized country here, we would have a hospital for sick poor in every county. And it's how the law that counties are responsible for their own sick poor started. And so Laguna Honda, as a San Francisco almshouse, was just one of hundreds, at least hundreds, of these almshouses across the country. What happened politically was that starting in the 1950s, so the 1950s, there was a big movement that came across the country to close them. And this was an interesting movement because it came from both the left and the right. The left wanted to close all the almshouses because they felt they were unjust, that it was wrong that the poor got not so much worse care, but certainly different care, certainly more old-fashioned care on big open wards than the rich. They thought it was unjust. And the right was delighted to close the almshouses because most of the almshouses was built, like Laguna Honda was, on 62 acres of land in the middle of San Francisco. Very valuable property. So there was a collusion, and almost all the almshouses in the country and many of the county hospitals, which were part of that whole system, were closed. And Laguna Honda, about 10 years into my work there, the Department of Justice showed up at the hospital because, as it turns out, they informed the hospital that we were in violation of our patients' civil rights, because it turns out we have a civil right, all of us, heads up here, to privacy. Because the wards, patients were on these big open wards, they had curtains around their beds, but they certainly didn't have private rooms. The Department of Justice informed the city of San Francisco that the old place had to close, and either San Francisco had to build a new, modern healthcare facility with private or semi-private rooms for the patients, or completely close it. So there was a huge battle against that in the San Francisco, and it took about the 10 years, the second 10 years I was there. Very interesting politics. And I talk about the politics also. The politics weaves its way through my book because I'm also using it as a lens to look at other things that have happened, the sort of equivalent things that have happened across the country in many other ways. For example, after all the almshouses were closed, the left and the right set their sights on the mental institutions, which had also developed in somewhat the same way, this idea that instead of keeping the mentally ill locked up in rooms
or a jail,
or
which
sometimes
they
in prison,
and
that's exactly what they had been. There's a big movement in the 1800s, late 1800s, early 1900s, to build. I'm not going to call them mental health institutions because it wasn't really. It was a mental ill institution. They were the state mental hospitals, and they came out of the same movement as the almshouses. And they were built in a lot of the same ways. They were usually old-fashioned places with a lot of people, and they were built usually in the country because there was an understanding that the mentally ill needed peace and quiet. And there was a big push also in the 50s, but it really mounted in the 80s, 1980s, to shut them all. In California, they were shut in the, when Reagan was governor in the 70s, he started shutting them all down. And the idea, of course, was a humanitarian idea. It was this idea that with the new antipsychotic drugs, that we could take care of the mentally ill in their community. That was the watchword. So there's going to be all these community mental health centers. They were going to be staffed by psychiatrists. We're going to take all the money that we saved from running these big mental health institutions, and we were going to invest them, quote-unquote, invest them in community mental health centers, and so they closed all of the they started closing them. They closed most of them. And they funded these community mental health centers for a few years, and then as soon as the first budget crisis came on, they stopped, and now we're left with hundreds of thousands of the mentally ill roaming the streets of our country, untreated, unhoused, and medically, physically ill. It's a scandal.
I agree.
It's an absolute scandal, and I don't know, there was just an article, there has been now for about 10 years, but there's really starting to be an understanding that these state mental health hospitals may not have been perfect, but they were sure a lot better for the mentally ill than anything that we have now, and there's a push now to bring them back, which is kind of interesting to see. So that's the kind of pressure that were put on Laguna Honda for the last 10 years I was there. And it was very interesting to watch up close. I've had a lot of positive feedback from people across the country who underwent the same things themselves. It's just been fascinating to see the repercussions of that. I mean, there's that adage about the perfect is the enemy of the good, and I would say that what's happened in our country with healthcare has been a perfect example of that.
Yeah, so unfortunately, so now the status is that it's closed?
It's even better. It's actually really good. So surprisingly, San Francisco, nobody expected it to, so San Francisco actually put a bond up, and nobody expected the bond to build a fancy new Laguna Honda would pass, because this was when things were really tight. The one before that. But it did pass 2-1 to rebuild a new Laguna Honda. And so I watched as this new, very beautiful, very modern Laguna Honda was built. And that was also very interesting to see, you know, the cost overruns and what I liked about it and what I didn't like about it. And serendipitously, the we moved in to, so it was built, it wasn't closed. We moved out of the old institution and into the new, very fancy one where the patients had these beautiful but pretty much private rooms. Very modern, very beautiful, very isolating, very lonely place, and get to see the advantages and disadvantages of a modern healthcare facility with the same patients. We moved the patients and staff in just about 4 years ago now. And I actually, at that point, I took time off to write God's Hotel, because when we moved in there, the plan was to blow up the old building and make a parking lot out of it. And I realized that once the old building was gone, no one would believe what had happened there in a good sense. I had had incredible patients, and most of the book is about these particular individual patients, what they taught me about slow medicine, about the importance of the personal in medicine, because one of the things we had at the old place, as opposed to the new place, was a huge amount of time with patients, right? Because nobody paid attention to us. We were like over the hill to the poorhouse, so we're pretty much left alone, and we did bill, but what I had that nobody else has these days is I had plenty of time to see my patients, to examine them, to talk to them, to meet their families, to call the docs up, to go over to the other hospitals and look at their x-rays and look at their labs myself, to try things. And then one of the main things I learned in the course of my 20 years there studying Hildegard was how important having enough time to be personal with my patients was, not just from the point of view of humanity, but from the point of view of efficiency. I think of everything I learned at that place, it was that when a doctor has enough time to get the right diagnosis and the right treatment, that's the most efficient healthcare of all.
And we're certainly losing that in today's modern medicine.
We are, and that is what absolutely has just compelled me to, my whole life has changed because of this book, because I'm just passionate. We have to give doctors and nurses back their time with patients. And the ironic thing is this whole, it's just the opposite's going on. Every time the economists get involved, and the suits and the administrators, their answer to rising costs is to put another layer of bureaucracy, another manager of some kind, another computer program between me and the patient. It takes time away from me and the patient, and what we can see is the more they do that, the more it costs, the less time I have with patients, and the more snarled things get. And so my sort of main mission here is to get everybody to pay attention to the fact that we need to give time back to doctors and nurses. And if we do, then we can combine the advantages of what I'm calling fast medicine technology, computers, whatever you like about that, with what I'm calling slow medicine, which is having enough time with patients and also this personal, you know, eye-to-eye and face-to-face between the doctor and the patient and the nurse and the patient. That's the heart of it.
Well, we're going to take just another break right here, Progressive Radio Network. We are speaking with Dr. Victoria Sweet, and we'll be back with her too. And she's talking about her book, God's Hotel. You can find her at victoriasweet.com. And when we come back, we will be talking about, if you'd like, Dr. Sweet, with some of the newer projects that you have envisioning for the future.
Mm-hmm.
We will be right back with more right here on Progressive Radio Network. You're listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Natural Nurse Ellen Kamai, and we'll be right back with you shortly.
Oh.
And welcome back once again to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We love to hear from you. So you can get in touch anytime by visiting us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And we always get comments about our shows, classes, books, courses, all the things that we offer. Take a look at naturalnurse.com. You can learn how to integrate natural medicine into your life, yourself, your family. And if you are a healthcare provider, you can learn how to access protocol management of natural remedies as you integrate them into your protocol. So we want to thank our guests so much today. We have today with us Dr. Victoria Sweet, and we're talking about one of the books that she wrote called God's Hotel, A Doctor, A Hospital, and A Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine, required reading for anyone interested in the business of healthcare and especially those interested in the humanity of healthcare. And you bring that all together in this book, Dr. Sweet.
Well, thank you very much, Ellen. So we were going to talk about what I'm doing now.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to get to that by telling you, by taking you on a little bit of a pilgrimage, my pilgrimage with me, because it was really this pilgrimage I took that solidified my thinking. So the way it worked for me was everything kind of happened kind of synchronistically. I finished my PhD, and at that point, I had decided as a present to myself, I'd heard about this medieval pilgrimage, and some of your listeners, or probably many of them, have heard about it. There was a movie about it called The Way, which happened after I took it. But pilgrimage was something that people did a lot in the Middle Ages, which is to walk. It's a spiritual journey, really, that you do on feet. That has a spiritual but also a physical goal. And in the Middle Ages, pilgrimage was a big deal. So having spent about 10 years, you know, learning Latin and German and looking at medieval manuscripts and studying Hildegard and many other authors, I wanted to see it for myself. I was quite taken with this idea of walking to Santiago de Compostela in Spain. That was the classic medieval pilgrimage, and you can still do it. The old medieval way on the medieval paths, staying in hospices or hostels or bed and breakfasts. And so I found a friend of mine from medical school who was willing to do it. And we spent about 4 years walking across Europe, walking across France, walking across Spain. The whole pilgrimage is about 1,200 miles. And one of the things that was fascinating to see was as we walked on these old medieval trails, they were lined with herbs. I carried a herb book with me, and I kept track of all the medicinal herbs we saw. And one of the things I thought was very interesting, as an aside, in a way, is that many of the herbs, many of the plants, their main characteristic was good for sore feet, which I thought was interesting. And when I was walking on that pilgrimage over those years, I found that the patients that had really influenced me and influenced the way I practice medicine and kind of opened up this whole model I'm calling slow medicine, as I was walking, their faces kind of showed up. Because when you're walking for, you know, 10, 15, 20 miles a day, you know, you kind of get into this different place. And I started taking notes because I'd never taken notes about my patients. I just kind of let them happen. I started taking notes, and that is what turned into my book, God's Hotel. And I wanted your listeners to know that because I've twined the pilgrimage in the sense of journey, in the sense of starting one place and getting to another into the book. At the end of the book, it was kind of interesting for me to, I didn't know anybody, but even in New York, there was a huge interest in this kind of thinking. And towards the end of the book, as I began to think of what, when I asked myself, what would I call what I'd learned at Laguna Honda, and I thought of this idea of calling it, of making that relationship to slow food as slow medicine, that whole idea has caught on tremendously. And there's now an immense pushback against this commodification of medicine, this computerization of everything, and it's been starting. I think God's Hotel has done quite a bit to get this movement going, but there is a big movement out there. It's fascinating to watch. And so I wasn't actually, to be honest, planning on writing another book particularly, but it's sort of become obvious as I've gone around the country speaking that people want to understand slow medicine. They want to understand your initial question you asked me about how I came to this, really. And also, I think, practical ways that we can get doctors and nurses back their time. So I got Guggenheim to do it. And the title of, you know, the title of the book at this point is, what I'm writing now, is called Slow Medicine, Healing in an Age of Technology. And, of course, it's a nicely ambiguous title, right? So it's how I learned about this, and how I think we can do it going forwards. So it's a pretty exciting time in my own life because I'm just determined to do my best to bring time and the personal to make sure it doesn't fall out of medicine. And
see, that's such a good goal, and also that you're focusing, because it's a big goal. You're talking about increasing the humanity in medicine, but just like, I'll give an example, the genetically modified GMO project that I've been involved with actually since 1969. Yes, folks, that's a six, because that's when I was a student at Cornell, and we were working on producing the genetically modified products, and I was against it even then. But nonetheless, where that has focused now on just labeling. So if we could just all focus on one thing and make that happen, it could lead to that larger goal. So I really like the way you're bringing a very big concept and years of study and a depth of understanding to both sides of the issue, talking about just time. And I'll tell you something that I'm sure you're aware of with both doctors and nurses. With those electronic records, what goes on in the interaction between the health provider and the patient now is that the health provider has their back to the patient, and they're typing into a terminal.
Yeah.
So what is that? Where could that possibly go? That's positive. You don't even smell the patient anymore. They don't even touch them. It's just that has been a horrendous change.
It is. It is. That is like, you know, I could spend the rest of the time we have just talking about the electronic medical record. It's actually way more scandal than people realize. And I say that because for two reasons. One is, you know, it was sold to us, so to speak, as efficient, and it was going to save all this kind of money. But you talk about evidence-based medicine. At the time, there was not a shred of evidence that it would save money, number one. We now have evidence that it takes 30% more time to do electronic medical records than it did to write on pieces of paper. The one thing that electronic medical records should do, and would be good if it would do, would be what they call interoperable. The one thing it could do that was better than a paper record is that I wouldn't have to call the hospital, right, and talk to the doc or have them, you know, fax me the labs or whatever.
Continuity of care.
Interoperable. That we'd be all in the same system. There's more than 1,000 different electronic medical record systems in this country,
and they don't
none
talk
of them
to each other. I know.
They deliberately set it up that way because they all want to be the one that ends up the top. So if they made it interoperable, they deliberately made it that way. And so we know now. There's a lot of studies that doctors are spending 30% more time. They're spending 70% of their time filling out those damn things.
Mm-hmm.
It is ridiculous. It's like we shot 30% of our doctors and 30% of it's like we disappeared them. And so when I get the pushback from whoever we want to call the enemy, you know, I get the pushback, oh, we couldn't have doctors have enough time with the patients. That would be so inefficient. I'm like, you talk about inefficient. You know, stop using electronic medical records or figure out a good way to do them. So the thing I'm pushing from a practical sense is there's the simplest possible way to do electronic medical records, and that is to make them like e-books. That the equivalent of the paper chart for that we used to use, right? That the easy paper chart had many advantages to that. Essentially, take that paper chart and turn it into the equivalent e-book per patient, and have those available on the cloud, so that when you go to the doctor, they can sort of pull down that e-book and literally write in it. There is no reason a doctor can't physically write in that thing with a, you know, stylus or whatever, and have that immediately accessible to everyone, and have it be as easy to use as a paper chart, because paper charts did not require me to turn my back on the patient and type in, you know, little things that only billing cares about. It's outrageous.
It is horrendous. You know, believe it or not, we're right about at the end of our time. Fascinating discussion. Please be sure to let us know when your new book comes out, because I'd love to continue that discussion.
Great.
I also want to tell our listeners that you have a TEDS talk.
Yes.
Which is fantastic. And you're really doing, you know, let's say God's hotel, God's work, because bringing back the humanity to medicine is an important goal, and one that really is not being stressed enough within the healthcare system. So thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Best place to find Dr. Sweet is victoriasweet.com. You'll see all about her story, her fantastic pilgrimage. I want to go on that one. That's on my to-do list in life now. I love Spain. And if you'd like to find out more, you can visit victoriasweet.com. You can always find us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.